Very pleasant good evening to all of you tonight. Hope you've had a good day. Started out a little chilly this morning, but it warmed up nicely. And best part of the day is we get to end it together as God's family here and to open our Bibles, study some things, sing these songs as we've done this evening, and leave here hopefully edified and encouraged and glad that we made the effort to come. I'm glad you're here, particularly so. Take your Bibles, if you will, and open to 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 1. 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 1. That's the passage that I want to read with you tonight and that I want you to mark in your Bible. 2 Corinthians 7, 1. Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. Do you see that last phrase in verse 1? That's what I want you to mark. Perfecting holiness in the fear of God. You say, what does that have to do with marriage? Everything. We'll come back to that in just a moment. We'll call his name Greg. Greg walked to his car after the golf tournament was over. And he hit the button on the keypad to unlock the doors, and nothing happened. He hit it again. Nothing happened. Now, he was able to take the key manually and get into the vehicle. But when he did, it wouldn't start. And that's when he noticed the gas gauge was empty. And that made no sense to him because he had filled up the tank that morning. And so he had to have the vehicle towed to the dealership. They got it to the dealership, hooked it up to the computer, and the mechanic came back and gave the diagnosis. He said, Greg, you have a bad BCM. That stands for the basic control module for this vehicle. If the basic control module goes bad, it's kind of the brain of your car, then not anything's going to work. Now, Greg could have insisted, I want you to fix the door locks. I want you to fix my keypad. I want you to fix the gas gauge. I want you to fix all of those particular single items. But Greg was smart enough not to do that. Because Greg understood if he could just get the basic control module fixed or replaced, everything else would begin to work properly. He understood those other things were mere symptoms of a much bigger problem. When it comes to marriage, ladies and gentlemen, homes and families, I wonder how often we only focus on the symptoms instead of the basic control module. And so here's a couple, and they sit down and they say, you know, we need to work on improving communication one with the other. Okay, but that's only a symptom. Somebody else comes in and they said, we need to get better at handling conflict, conflict resolution. Okay, but that's a symptom. Another couple says, we need to be more about showing affection, appreciation for one another. Yes, okay, but that's a symptom. And we can spend all of our time focusing on each individual symptom, or we can replace the basic control module. And the basic control module for the Christian is a spiritual focus. It is a spiritual motivation. That's why he says in chapter 7 of 2 Corinthians in verse 1, we are to perfect holiness in the fear of God. God is to take first place in everything. Here's my question. Is marriage exempt from that? Or would marriage be included in that? I want to think with you a little bit tonight on this subject, a little different than maybe we sometimes approach it. Let me begin by asking you a very simple question. based upon 2 Corinthians 7:1. Are you a God-centered spouse? Or are you a spouse-centered spouse? There's a big difference. A spouse-centered spouse acts nice toward her husband as long as he acts nice towards her. A spouse-centered spouse will go out of his way for his wife as long as she remains agreeable and affectionate. But what I see in Scripture is that God demands more from us than that. Paul says, look, as Christians, he says, we are to perfect holiness in the fear of or out of reverence for God. The number one motivating factor in all that we do, including this very special earthly relationship called marriage, the number one motivating factor in all that we do, he says, is reverence for God. I'm not called to love my wife because she's holier than anybody else. I'm not called to love my wife because she always makes me happy. I'm not called to love my wife because everything between us, every single day, all of the time, is this wonderful ooey-gooey kind of feeling. That's not it at all. I'm called to love my wife out of reverence for God, period. 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 1. Perfecting holiness in the fear of God. That says to me, that communicates to me, that every decision that I make, every attitude that I have, every action that I take needs to flow from this high and holy motivation. Is this something that pleases Him? Is this something that honors God? And I think if we did that, if that was first and foremost in our minds, then all of our relationships would be better, including this one. You know, when I was in school, got a lot of quotes from this guy named Socrates. Remember him? I'm going to give you my favorite all-time Socrates quote. You ready? Here it is. My favorite Socrates quote. By all means, get married. If you get a good wife, you'll be happy. If you get a bad wife, you will become a philosopher. Socrates. Maybe that tells you a little bit about Socrates. Why didn't God design this thing called marriage? Why didn't He make it easier? It sounds easy. From the outside looking in, it looks easy. But it's not. My wife was here Sunday. Some of you met her. She went to a wedding not too long ago and was going through the receiving line after it was over and the hugs and kisses for the bride and all that kind of deal. And she got to the bride and they just gave each other a big hug. And the bride said to Julie, she said, "Oh, I'm just so glad the hard part's over." And Julie said, honey, the hard part's just getting started. What are you talking about? You ever notice when you watch a television romantic comedy or movie that's a romantic comedy? They're all the same. Every one of them is identical. I hate to blow it for you, but here's the script. There is a beautiful couple, they meet under improbable circumstances, and they fall in love. And then they fall out of love, and then in the final 30 minutes, they fall back in love, the end. That's it. They're all exactly the same. And Hollywood has a way of making it look, this relationship, making it look so easy. Well, it's not easy. One of the reasons it's not easy is because romantic love has no elasticity. Romantic love cannot be stretched. You try to stretch romantic love and it'll just shatter. Because romantic love, if you start peeling away all the layers, really is all about me. It's about you making me happy. Mature love, on the other hand, God love, holy love, stretches farther than you can possibly imagine. It has to stretch and stretch and stretch. Because when two sinful, selfish people start living together as one, there's going to be problems. There's going to be trouble. Unless each embrace a higher and holy motivation. And that means reverence for God. So think with me about marriage. You think maybe God has a higher purpose for this relationship than two people just living at the same address and sharing the same mailbox and sharing the same kitchen table and sharing the same bedroom? You think maybe God's got something higher in mind than just that? You think God has something higher in mind than just your happiness? How about this? Maybe it's not your happiness as much as your holiness that He is interested in. Now, I'm not saying when it comes to marriage that happiness and holiness are mutually exclusive. I'm not saying that. I'm saying when all of us look at our relationship through the lens of God's purpose, it gives you a whole new perspective. Because what it does is say to me, hey, this marriage thing is not all about me. There's more to it than that. I tell couples sometimes, if you want to learn the ugly side of you, if you want to learn the ugly side of you, then get married. Because marriage will confront your immaturity. Marriage will confront your selfishness. Marriage will confront your control mongering. More than anything else. Which brings up an interesting question. What's the purpose? What is the purpose between this very intense, lifelong relationship? What's the real purpose? Maybe the real purpose is to draw me closer to God. Maybe we don't think about it that way, but we should. My relationship with my spouse is only so long. My relationship with God is forever. We need to think about that. My relationship with God will outlast my relationship with her. That's why just working on the symptoms won't work very, very well. Listen, you can make your home more pleasant and peaceful, and you should try to do that. You can look for ways to keep the romance alive, and you should do that. You can show respect for the other and kindness and courtesy and be polite and do all of those things. You should do all of those things. But if your relationship with God is not what it ought to be, then you're sticking Band-Aids on symptoms. The problem sometimes is we look in another person. We look for that other person to fill a void that only God can fill. I think sometimes that's why marriage dissatisfaction runs so high. Maybe marriage dissatisfaction runs so high because maybe we're expecting too much from our spouse. My first computer was a 486. Anybody have a 486 computer years ago? I think they had a 386. Did they have a 386 and then a 486? Julie and I were in the Smithsonian a couple years ago in that area. We went through the Smithsonian, the Museum of American History. And we're going through there, and she said, look, hon, there's your computer. You know you're getting old when you go through the Smithsonian and your stuff is on display. Now, that tells you you're getting old. Here's the deal. It's kind of like running today's programs on an old 486. It won't work. It just won't work. It's not that the old 486 was bad in its time. It was the latest thing in its time. It's just that now you'd be asking it to do more than it was capable of doing. Maybe we do that in our relationships as husbands and wives. Maybe we ask too much. If I'm seeking the largest proportion of my life fulfillment and my life satisfaction from my spouse, then I'm asking too much. Because first and foremost, I was created with a craving, with an eternal craving for the Creator. Created to have a relationship with God that would last for eternity. My wife isn't God. Your husband isn't God. Only God can fill that eternal itch within the soul of mankind. When we finally get that, when we understand the basic control module for the Christian is God, and it's living our life out of reverence for Him, first and foremost, and everything else is subservient to that. Then and only then will I have a brand new appreciation for the person with whom I have embarked on this lifelong journey together. Now then, it's amazing to me in both Old Testament and New Testament how often God connects His relationships with people to marriage. I'm convinced that He does that to help us understand. For example, in passages like Isaiah 62 and verse 5, He talks about, as a bridegroom rejoices over the bride, God rejoices over you, He says. In Matthew 9 and verse 15, Jesus refers to Himself as the bridegroom. In Matthew chapter 21, beginning in verse 1, the kingdom of heaven is compared to a wedding banquet. In the book of Revelation, chapter 19 and verse 7, it talks about the wedding of the Lamb and says the bride has made herself ready. You go back to the Old Testament, same thing. In the Old Testament, the breakdown of spiritual fidelity between Israel or Judah and Jehovah is depicted in the terms of marital infidelity. Passages like Jeremiah 3 and verse 8. I gave Israel her divorce and I sent her away because of her adulteries, he says. So he puts it in language that we can understand. But perhaps no place is the sacredness of marriage seen any clearer for us than in the fifth chapter of the book of Ephesians. In Ephesians chapter 5, where holy matrimony is compared to the holy relationship between Christ and His church. In Ephesians 5 and verse 22, wives, be subject to your own husbands as to the Lord. In verse 25, husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself up for her. Notice the comparison. Verse 29, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but he nourishes it and cherishes it. What's the comparison? As Christ does the church. Verse 31, for this reason a man shall leave father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This mystery is great, but I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Nevertheless, each individual among you is to love his own wife, even as himself, and the wife must see to it that she respect her husband. How can you not read that and come away with less of appreciation for the sacredness of marriage and the understanding as to why it is called holy matrimony? What a comparison to help us understand how sacred this relationship is. Go back to 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 9. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 9, here's another verse that I think will help us. 2 Corinthians 5 verse 9. Therefore, he says, we also have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to Him. Would marriage be exempt from that? Or would marriage be included? The first purpose of this relationship goes beyond sexual expression, goes beyond companionship, goes beyond all of that, goes beyond the bearing of children, goes beyond all of that. It comes down to this. Are we pleasing to Him? So somebody comes in and they sit down and they say, well, my marriage is a wreck because Frank doesn't make me happy. And I just want to go, newsflash. It's not about your happiness. Look at verse 9. Therefore we have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, what's number one? To be pleasing to Him. In 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 31, whether you eat or drink, whatever you do, I think marriage is included in the whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Marriage is not exempt from that, ladies and gentlemen. And if that were not enough, look in verse 15. 2 Corinthians 5, 15. And He died for all so that they who live, here it is, might no longer live for self, but for Him who died and rose again on their behalf. What's the goal of our life? To live for Him. What's the goal of our marriage? To live for Him. God is demanding me that I look at my relationship with my spouse and I look at it through the lens of His perspective. And God says, wait a minute. Your marriage is not about your happiness. Your marriage is not about your glory and your honor. Your marriage is about bringing glory and honor to Me, says God. And I think, ladies and gentlemen, sometimes we forget that. While we're in 2 Corinthians 5, go down to verse 18. Now all these things are from God who reconciled us to Himself through Christ and gave to us the ministry of reconciliation. Paul talks about this ministry of reconciliation. Now, I believe Paul is talking specifically about the commission that Jesus gave the apostles to go into all of the world and preach the gospel to all men in the Great Commission. I understand that. I get that. I think that's the specific application. But let me ask you a question. Is not the work of the gospel, is not the work of the church, in a sense, is it not the ministry of reconciliation? Is that not what we're all about? To be able to share the good news of the gospel. And what is the good news? That God has reconciled us to Himself through His Son via His death on the cross? Sure it is. You say, well, what does that have to do with my marriage relationship? All right, think. Reconcile. 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 I got it. Irreconcilable differences. You ever heard that? Irreconcilable difference. The point is, if our homes are fraught with fighting and animosity and anger and distrust and resentment, guess what's happened? Our marriage has contradicted our message. And what is our message? Our message is reconciliation. And if my very marriage contradicts my message, then I have sabotaged the goal of my life. And what is the goal of my life? Verse 9. To be pleasing to Him. The goal of my life is to be pleasing to Him and to be able to share the message of reconciliation to other people. You see, a marriage that is God-honoring and serves God first and foremost is a marriage, is a relationship that puts flesh on the picture of reconciliation. It is a marriage that will model before others forgiveness and selfless love and sacrifice. And ladies and gentlemen, what do you think are the basics of reconciliation? The basis of reconciliation, if not those things. forgiveness and selfless love and sacrifice. So maybe what we do for one another in the marriage relationship in that regard, maybe, is but a small taste of what God does and keeps doing for us. Here's what I'm saying tonight. Your marriage will either be a stumbling block or a stepping stone to the gospel message. That's how important this is. How can I tell my kids that God's promise of reconciliation is sound and secure if my promises don't mean a thing? How could that be? In Romans 12 and verse 18, there's an exception here. Paul says, as far as it depends upon you, be at peace with all men. Sometimes you learn a hard lesson in life, and it's this. There's only one person you can control. Only one. And that's yourself. And if your spouse is bound and determined to be morally unfaithful, I want to tell you, there's not anything you can do about that. And Jesus understood that in Matthew chapter 19. In Matthew chapter 19 and verse 9, he said very, very plainly, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for immorality and marries another woman commits adultery. God allows marital unfaithfulness to break the bond of holy matrimony, and he allows the innocent one to put away the guilty one. I heard somebody say one time, they said, I don't think there's any such thing as the innocent party. Well, what that person meant was, there's no such thing as a perfect party. But ladies and gentlemen, it's not about perfection. It never is. It is always about one thing, glorifying God in my life. See, there's one question you have to ask every situation you're in, whether it's this one or any other. There's one question you have to ask always. What would God want me to do? And if it is possible to reconcile, then there's your answer. Sometimes it's not possible because of the behavior of the other person. Sometimes it means making very hard decisions, especially when young lives, spiritual lives, hang in the balance. And Jesus talked about that. But the point is this. We live in a culture, we live in a society where marriages are just discarded with regularity. Where people make promises and don't ever intend to keep them, or at least for very long. Where spouse bashing is a favorite pastime. And that's all around us. But I tell you what you see. When you see a Christian couple and they work very hard to maintain a God-glorifying relationship, those folks command attention. You see, our lives, our relationships, our marriages become platforms of evangelism. I don't think we think about it that way. Our relationships become platforms of evangelism. By our very example, we can lead others to Him, or we can push them away. So let me ask you a question. How many of you tonight have been married 30 years? Raise your hand. At least 30 years, raise your hand. 40 years. He's got a count.
He's close.
We're close. 39. 40. 50. 58. He told me that a while ago. 60. 100. I was doing this someplace. I was going through these numbers, and I said 100, and some guy raised his hand. I pointed, and he goes, it feels like it. Oh, I can't imagine the discussions they had on the way home. When you have people who are married 30, 40, 50, 60 years, I want to tell you what that is. That's not a testimony that everything, you know, we younger, we look at that and we go, oh, they got it. They haven't had any problems. Are you kidding me? These people are living testimonies to the love of God, to things like forgiveness and patience and kindness and commitment and reconciliation. Their very lives show the very basis, the very basics of the gospel message itself. Now I want to leave you with one more thing. We're going to quit. If you're married to a Christian, your spouse is not just your spouse. Your spouse is God's daughter. Your spouse is God's son. And we don't think about that. You're married to a child of God. Now, think with me for just a minute. If you want to get on the good side of a parent, then you better be good to their kids. The flip side of that is, if you want to make a parent very, very angry, then pick on their child. Be the bully. Be mean to him or her, and you will fire up parental indignation. Do you think it's any different with God? In Zechariah 2 and verse 8, he says of his people, he says, listen, if you touch them, you're touching the apple of his eye. That's how God views his children. The apple of my eye, he says. So when you got married, you married a child of God. So it's not just about me and my attitude toward just another person out here. It's about me and my attitude toward a daughter of God. Toward a child of God. That makes it pretty special. Now let's take the analogy a step further. We talk about the fatherhood of God. Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount taught us to pray. When we pray, we should pray, "Our Father who art in heaven." Okay, extend that. If God is the father of the woman you marry, guess what that makes him, guys? He's your father-in-law. Which says, as a Christian, when I fail to respect my wife, when I demean her, or I mistreat her in some way, or I speak condescendingly to her, I'm courting trouble with my father-in-law. In 1 Peter 3 and verse 7, he speaks to men and he says, you better honor your wife as a fellow heir of the grace of life. You're not any better than she is. She's not any better than you are. You're fellow heirs of the grace of life. And he says, you better honor her with all of your being, or else, he says, you're going to have trouble with your father-in-law. Because he goes on in the passage and says, if you don't treat her right, your prayers will be hindered. I think we fail to grasp sometimes how passionate God is about the person to whom we're married. First of all, he designed your spouse as a one and only kind. There is no other one like her or him. He not only designed your spouse as a one and only, he loved your spouse so much that he sent his son to die on the cross for him or her to reconcile him or her to him through his son Jesus. That makes your spouse pretty special. And that makes God very interested as to how you treat your spouse. We have four children, three of whom are married, one still in college. And it's always been our prayer that our children will marry spouses who will love them, who will love them as much as I love them. But I will tell you, as their dad, all four of my children have imperfections. All four of my children have quirks. All four of my children have limitations. Well, because I do. So my prayer is that they will marry a spouse who will be understanding of all of those things. They'll marry someone who will be very kind to them, be very forgiving of them, be very patient with them. I would cringe to think that one of my children would marry someone who would be abusive to them, or cruel, or hurt them in some way. Now, God is fully aware that your spouse has limitations too. God is fully aware that your spouse has quirks, that your spouse is not perfect. God is fully aware of all of it. But He's asking you to do something. He wants you to be as forgiving and as patient with their faults as you would want your kids' spouses to be with them. That's how important this is. And I think these are some things that sometimes, ladies and gentlemen, we don't ever think about. Think about how you treated your spouse this past week. Is that how you would want your daughter treated by her spouse? Is that how you would want your son?